so important to be safe online. You don't give out your real name, you don't give out your date of birth, you don't give out where you live. Because if you look at, and I say this to anybody listening to this today, if you have your own social media, is your photo on the profile? Is your location? Do you have pictures of your family, of your friends, of your kids? If there was someone wanted to do something against you, what could they learn about you by looking at that profile?
Welcome to The Lid Is On, a podcast series from UN Radio in New York. I'm Paulina Greer. Before we start, a warning that this episode is not appropriate for young listeners, but you might want to discuss some of these themes with your children. On this episode, we discuss cybercrime and how to protect children from being sexually abused.
Hi, I'm Neil Walsh. I'm the head of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crimes Global Program on Cybercrime, based in Vienna.
The UN Office, known as UNODC, is one of the UN agencies that works to protect children online. That has been Neil's job for almost 20 years. Before the UN, he was a police officer and went on to work with Europol. That's the European Union's law enforcement agency in The Hague, and then with the United Kingdom's National Crime Agency. As we started talking, Neil mentioned that a child abuser, before being detected and arrested, is active an average of 13 years. That's an estimate from the United States Department of Justice. And when arrested, an average pedophile is in the process of grooming or abusing up to 70 kids. That's 70.
A question I had last year at a conference was, what's the profile of a sex offender? What do they look like? And that's the biggest challenge, Paulina. It could be you, it could be me, it could be a guy you walk past in the street, it could be a family member. Most children are abused by someone that they know. Someone that's either linked to the family or linked to the wider family circle or that social network. However, those who are groomed and exploited online, then there may be no familial link, and that's where we look at a different type of risk now, at trying to identify paedophiles who will try to recruit children. Maybe those who are playing games online, and there's that anonymity involved, so you might play a game live with 1,000 other people playing the same game. That's where we see real risk starting to occur now, which is why we try to teach kids and parents and caregivers about what that risk looks like and how we can do something about it.
So you're talking about these games like fantasy playing,
yep,
or shooting.
Yep.
And these sex offenders, these pedophiles, will, mm-hmm, reach out to, mm-hmm, the actual kids. How do they know? I mean, how do they know that these are kids playing these games?
We look at some games that are particularly targeted towards children, or there are social network platforms that are more targeted towards children. Pedophiles will seek to infiltrate those and pretend to be children. So if we look, for example, use the terms of grooming. So grooming is where an adult pretends to be a child, typically, to try and recruit them to become their friend and then sexually exploit them. So that individual will pretend to be someone around the same age as the child, or maybe even try and socially engineer that child to make them think that they already know each other. And this is where we teach kids that it's so important to be safe online. You don't give out your real name. You don't give out your date of birth. You don't give out where you live, who you go to school with. Because if you look at, and I say this to anybody listening to this today, if you have your own social media, maybe you're on Facebook, maybe you're on Twitter, whatever, proactively, objectively, have a look at that and what information are you giving out there. Is your photo on the profile? Is your location? Is your date of birth? Do you have pictures of your family, of your friends, of your kids? If there was someone wanted to do something against you, what could they learn about you by looking at that profile? If we then apply that to children, then if they're giving out what their best friend is called, or the school they go to, their favourite shop to buy clothes, and you look at a preteen teenager who's going to a shop, then suddenly if you have an offender online who can build up this picture of that child, it's really easy for them to convince a child that they're a friend, that they know them already. Hey, I saw you in the store the other day.
So what is your office doing to help parents to protect children?
Cyber crime, cyber-enabled crime, and especially online child abuse, it's one of the most preventable bits of crime if we do it properly. And it's about education, it's about making people aware of threat, not in a way that we're wishing to scare people. We don't want to make people say, don't go online, but we can minimise risk. And it's about understanding what that risk is and being conscious in our decisions. When we speak to children, if I say, if you and I sitting here talking now, we're sitting in a radio studio, this is real life for us. if you have a conversation with a child or teenager, if you say, well, what happens in real life, what happens in online life, they don't see that distinction. If someone came up to you in the street and said, hey, take your clothes off for me, tell me your real name, give me your bank account details, you're going to go and call the police. But if it happens online, we don't see that same level of risk awareness and that same decision making. There is a fallacy that online is safer and that you can trust what you're getting. The reason I'm in New York today is that we're a colleague and I were talking this afternoon about an initiative called Education for Justice that's being run by UNODC, so the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. And through Education for Justice, which is funded by the government of Qatar, we are building educational material to help caregivers, educationalists around the world to teach about UNODC's mandates, and mine being cybercrime. So if we build something that we can then go into schools and we teach teachers on how to teach this online safety concept, and we use, there's lots of remarkable educational material out there already, and we're working with people from private sector, from NGOs through to other universities around the world to help build this material that's culturally relevant and explains what threat is. So my colleague Nayeli Loya, based in El Salvador, runs our program in Central America. And in the past year alone, she and the people we work with have seen over 11,000 kids in El Salvador. So we have a puppet show for the younger kids that we go into school, and it explains what cybercrime is, it explains what online risk is, and helps kids in a very easy to understand, non-threatening way. And then we get into discussions with older kids heading towards preteen into teenage years, really discussing what actually happens in their lives. What do they do online? How do they manage that risk? What if you're doing something actually entirely consensually? How do you manage that risk? So let's say you're a teenager, you're in a relationship with someone, and you decide to share a picture naked or sexually explicit with someone. Problem is, when you've done that, it's out there forever. And something that is on the internet, even if you delete it from the website that you're on. You've seen in the past couple of years when celebrities have had their accounts hacked or compromised, and maybe they've had sexual or naked pictures there. And they're out there because other sites will then copy them straight away. They won't take them down if you ask. So it's about managing that risk. And I recognise the kids don't honestly care what's going to happen in 30 years' time. If you try to say to them, now, what's this going to look like when you're 60? They don't care. But it's what is the here and now, that how could that harm you?
What are the new trends that parents should be aware of?
Yeah, it's certainly become more difficult. I'd be lying if I didn't say that. I think there's some remarkable technical capability to minimise access to child abuse material online. So there's work that Interpol does, which allows law enforcement to identify online child sexual exploitation material that sits online. And that's on the normal open internet. So if you open a normal internet browser today and you try and find child abuse material, it's really quite difficult. A lot of it is already taken off. However, what we do see now is the exploitation by offenders of social media, of using encrypted apps to share material, and also by using a thing that we refer to as the darknet or hidden services. And that's simply software that you can download, but it allows you to access sites that you can't access through a normal internet browser. And if I look back on an operation of a couple of years ago where we had a small group of offenders, but they were sharing the most horrendous abuse material. And I think those of us who ever work in this field, there's some things that you never forget and things that you wish you'd never seen or read. And these individuals were sharing images. Again, it was babies and infants, so the highest risk in terms of physical harm. And doing it on a site that's on the darknet is encrypted, it is hidden. It's very difficult for law enforcers to try and identify where this is hosted, in which country, in which city, who the offenders are behind it, and then to try and identify the kids behind it and try and safeguard them. So the offenders that are involved in this are very skilled technically at what they do. They do a lot of things to try and make it harder for the police to investigate. They will try and do things to identify where law enforcers are doing things, look at the skill set of policing and try and work their way around that and try and defeat what we do. I think the thing that makes me much more, I think, reassured is that policing is doing an enormous amount of work on this. We have very good collaboration with industry, with private sector. If I look at some of our policing partners, specifically Queensland Police in Australia, Task Force Argos is their child protection team, and a guy there called Detective Inspector John Rouse. They are the world leaders in what we're doing in fighting online child abuse. The work that they have done to take down global offenders, working with partners across the world, including US, UK, other jurisdictions, working with Europol and Interpol, has saved thousands of lives, literally thousands of lives, and identified kids at real risk. So I think the message to those who are listening who are involved in this, and there will be people listening to this who are paedophiles or who are attracted to children, we will find you and you will be prosecuted and you will be dealt with.
What do you think makes Queensland, that department, so effective?
I think they've put an enormous amount of resource into it, so they've really focused on the skill set that's necessary to deal with the most difficult aspects of investigating online and darknet-based child abuse. So they've focused on the technical wherewithal, but most important, like anything we do, it's about relationships. Get people that you can work with, get people who are dedicated to doing this, who want to make a difference. They have an annual conference called the Youth Technology and Virtual Communities Conference every year. And I was speaking with a woman this year who opened the conference called Sonia Ryan.
Neil was so moved by Sonia and the story of what happened to her daughter Carly that he invited her to speak at a UN event later this year. And here's why.
Carly was very trusting and loving, and of course her relationships in her own life were very real. And everybody around her, the only thing she'd ever experienced in her life was love. We were really no match for a criminal using this space to manipulate and deceive and try and infiltrate her life. You know, he would speak like a teenager and he would ask her things, you know, how's school, how's your mum, how's life, you know. So there was a lot of time spent gaining trust. And, you know, since losing Carly, I've come to learn these techniques through my work with police. But at that time, nothing prepared us for a criminal working in this way. Carly introduced me to whom I thought was this young boy, Brandon's father, when in actual fact, the man I was speaking to was the man that was pretending to be Brandon as well. We chatted on the phone. She really desperately wanted to meet Brandon, and I believe that he promised that she would meet Brandon, and this is why I think my daughter went to meet with him alone without telling me, because she actually truly believed that she was going to go and meet Brandon after all this time. And somehow he convinced Carly to meet him, you know, without telling me. And I believe she was just going to a friend's house that she would normally do. And unfortunately, she went to meet Gary. And I don't know whether he told her that Brandon wasn't real, or I don't know exactly what unfolded that evening. But he took her life from her and murdered her in February 2007.
Sonia started the Carly Ryan Foundation in honor of her daughter. And she fought to get politicians in Australia to pass Carly's law, making it a crime for an adult to use services, such as the internet, to prepare to harm a child, so the police can intervene before the criminals get their hands on the child.
I believe that what I'm doing through her work with her legacy, Carly's law, creating legislation to help prevent harm against children, is very much in line with what I think she'd want me to do. And It's that the love connection between her and I that has really given me the strength to be able to do the work that I'm doing now to protect other people's children.
As a parent, what would you suggest to other parents that they do to help their children?
Communicate and learn about the mediums that they're using. So, you know, if your child's using Snapchat, find out everything you can about that medium. Research it. Look at the privacy settings. Make sure your kids know to have their location services turned off. So it's all about, you know, education, being empowered with that information. Honestly, connection and communication and discussion, and being up to date with what the kids are doing, who they're talking to, and getting the kids to understand that what motivates this is love and care for them. It's not about being nosy and wanting to interrupt their connections. It's more about getting them to understand that not everybody online is who they say they are, and understanding that that they must be really careful and mindful when they're connecting in their spaces.
Is there something that you want to just let the listeners know about Carly, you know, as a daughter, as a friend?
Oh, she was just amazing. She was really the light of my life. She was so bright and happy and loving and, you know, very creative. She was just such a beautiful girl. She was very compassionate from a very young age. And, you know, truly, I believe that I'm doing what she would want me to do.
Here's Neil again.
For her to stand up as a mum who's gone through this and advocate for victims and explain what that's like and try and do something that makes a difference, I don't know. I don't know how she does it, and I take my hat off to her. But the work that she does, the work then working with people like John, it changes legislation, it changes government approach to this. And I think this is where we have such an impact. So the work that my people are doing, not just to help investigation, but to make people, communities alive to what this risk is vital. When we make policymakers and government aware of what this is, then we actually start to do something that makes a difference. So if we look at individual police forces, individual agencies that are doing something, our role at the UN is and ought to be about bringing this together and showing what can we do globally that grows the ability to do something about this.
What is the greatest challenge that you're facing? Is it the fact that there's not enough money behind this? Is it the fact that you're dealing with such a sensitive topic that member states just don't even want to talk about it?
All of those things. There, I don't think I could isolate one specific thing. Money and investment is always important, but for example, if you look at regular capacity building or technical assistance across organised crime and counter-terror, often the approach is you need to have legislation and then you build technical assistance of law enforcement around that. My sense of things in cyber is that you need to do it a little bit differently. And the reason is I met with a number of governments last year, and I won't say where they were, but governments who say this doesn't exist for us. This doesn't happen in our communities. It doesn't happen in our country. This is not true. So our role is to help governments understand that risk is there and to help them carefully, diplomatically, to grow their ability to address this threat. Because this threat exists in every country. We have seen from where videos, from where images, from where written material for child abusers is hosted, it happens in every country. And if a specific country says this doesn't happen here, then actually you create a jurisdiction of risk where if I was a child abuser, I would think, right, where do I want to host my material? Well, let's do it in a country where there's no law. Let's do it where there's no policy. Let's do it where the government says this doesn't exist because maybe culturally, maybe politically, it's uncomfortable. So what we need to do is have that conversation and help governments to have that conversation. And we're working with some governments who I think have taken a very brave step to accept that they have a problem and have sought our help in doing something about it. And that's still what makes me get out of bed every day, that we do something that makes a difference, that sometimes it's okay, we have a policy discussion, what does it lead to? If you sit with a parliamentarian and you explain what this risk is, then you see some resource being put into law enforcement, you bring in legislation which makes this illegal, and it gives the opportunity to do something about it. And then we give them the technical capability to actually identify offenders and take them out. That's great. And when we do the public outreach, when we speak to kids, we always get victims self-reporting after that and coming up and saying, hey, this has happened to me. So you've created a space that makes victims safe and willing to come forward and talk about it and seek help. And that's a lovely thing to be able to do.
Everything you're describing is taking time. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I'm thinking of as you're talking and making laws, passing legislation, changing minds. Meanwhile, it seems like every day there's someone new who's being victimized. You know, it's outrageous, but doesn't it make sense? Let's just shut down the internet. Would that solve the problem? You know, let's get rid of the dark web.
I know it's a very common thing to hear, and there's a gut instinct in that, but I hate seeing, for example, if you get a kid run over by a drunk driver, no one wants to see that. But the solution isn't banning cars. It's about having a proportionate response to this. And we still have to come from the position that the internet is good. It is good for society. It helps kids in so many ways. It helps society in so many ways. We are much, much better for having it. And shutting it down actually wouldn't prevent it. So this is where if we empower kids to understand what that risk is, then you minimise that. But I'll give you an example of how actually this comes back to one of the key things of the UN now is the Sustainable Development Goals. So this is a programme through to 2030 where the UN's working to do lots of different, 17 different goals to make development a key priority across the world and minimise lots of different risks. So making sure people have access to water and there's a we minimise poverty and everything that goes with that. Seeing a link between things like online child abuse and poverty, you try and think, well, how could they possibly be linked? An operation that we recently supported and mentored was the live streaming abuse of babies and infants in a certain part of the world where poverty is a real issue. We helped to grow some relationships between law enforcers where they had identified that a very young baby was being live stream abused online by her parents. So an abuser sitting in Europe, the US, somewhere else, would pay per view for something to be done to this baby, and the parents would do that. And we identified, or at least the law enforcers identified, where this child was likely to be based, very rural area in a country where there is real socioeconomic problems. So I think sitting as a former cop, you think, okay, we're going to go and identify the baby, arrest mum and dad, job done, everybody's happy, child's safe. When the police went to this address and identified where the baby was, mum and dad said, yeah, we know it's wrong. We know what we're doing is horrendous. But the money that we make from this is feeding the children in the school in the village. And that, for me, I mean, that really gave me pause for thought, that we have people making a moral, ethical decision to harm their children because they need to afford to feed kids, not just in their family, but in their village. And this is where it comes back to, if we do something as the UN system is to try and make people's lives better, that's why we all joined it. And in whatever this enormous system is, that we do something that makes people's lives better. And it never was more clear to me at that moment that if there were jobs in this community, if there was economic prosperity, if there was good governance, good structure, minimising of political corruption, minimising risk that allows communities to be undermined, people don't harm their kids. Again, that's still something that sits very dear to my heart now, that understanding how this whole thing links together, that I think there's such a broad propensity for child abuse, criminality and crime generally, you can't arrest your way out of it. You could invest in hundreds or thousands of police and prosecutors and everything else. It'll still happen. So what we have to do is focus not just on the investigative aspect and the bringing people to justice, which is vital, but if we can minimise that risk by teaching kids, teaching parents how to keep themselves safe, but at the same time, the other parts of the UN system, it's about growing that economic prosperity. It's about making people's lives and communities more sustainable in such a way that they don't make these choices. I'm not trying to minimise what the parents have done. What they have done is a horrendous crime, and they deserve to be held to justice for that. And that child is now safe, thank God. And I think because she's so young, she won't remember what has happened to her. She's had the medical treatment to make her better. But the broader concept of people doing something to make money because they feel they need to, that is just fundamentally wrong. So if we can do something that helps to deal with that, on a global level, that's what we're about, and that is what we're doing.
Do you avoid going to certain countries knowing what's happening?
No, because this happens in most countries. maybe not for the reason that I've just discussed, but kids are abused in every society around the world.
You're a father? I am a mother now, and this is something that worries me greatly. When did you start having conversations with your children about being safe online, and what have you told them?
Absolutely. It's a great question, and they get it from the earliest of ages now, even before they really understand what it's about. Anytime I, in the past, spoke with children who had been abused, we really started to get a sense, and speaking with forensic doctors and physicians and forensic psychologists, kids who identify that they're being abused, those who are more likely to report, more likely to seek help, they understand what their bodies are, they understand the name of every bit of their bodies, they're not ashamed or embarrassed to say it. You know, from the very early age, my kids know what every bit of their body is called, what its real anatomical name is, and not be ashamed to say that. You know, my daughter came home from school one day and said, when she was 5 years old, and said one of her classmates had touched her vagina. And that was great that she came home and said that, or wasn't embarrassed to say that and doesn't mind saying that, because then the next morning I have a conversation with the teacher and say, hey, what's that about? And yeah, there's a slightly crazy kid in the class that they needed to have a conversation with. But when we speak to kids who have survived abuse, if they have been told, this is a secret between you and me, and you don't tell anybody, and I'm allowed to do this because I'm your dad, or I'm your uncle, or I'm your mum, or I'm your sister's best friend, then creating that element of secrecy makes it really hard for them to come out and have that confidence to tell someone. There was a lovely campaign that I saw actually on a pack of diapers recently called the Pants Campaign. So I think in British English, pants is your underwear, so not trousers. But anything that's in your pants is private. No one gets to touch that without your permission. So if I'm washing my kids now, even from the youngest baby through to the 5 and 6 year old, I say, I need to wash your bum, is that okay? And there's an element of a conversation and of consent in that, and we teach kids, your body is yours, no one gets to touch you. Sometimes, okay, mummy or daddy might have to clean you here or help you here, or we have to go to the doctor and they have to do something, but we're going to tell you what that is, and you're going to be part of that because it's your body. And that way they understand that growing up and moving forward, and they become their own best friend. They know what's right and wrong. They know what something that is wrong feels like. So then that minimises the risk of when a paedophile tries to groom them or do something that says, hey, this is okay, I'm allowed to do this because I'm your uncle, I'm your dad, I'm your teacher, then you've really minimised that risk where they say, hey, actually, I've been told from the moment that I started that this is wrong.
I remember talking with a friend of mine years ago who had worked on these issues, and she said that, you know, being surrounded by this, it really affected her and her colleagues to the point that some people wouldn't want to bathe their children.
Yeah.
How has this affected you?
That's the first time I've ever been asked that. You leave a little bit with, I think, with some of the most horrendous cases, and every case was horrendous, but there are still some that stick in my mind. Some that were image-based, but I guess one that really sticks in my mind was reading a Skype chat between a female offender who was in her late teens and was describing to an offender what she wanted to see done to her baby. And when it's written, you then apply that to a child that you know. So when I was working in that case, my eldest daughter was 6 months old. So there is a real risk of psychological trauma to those who work in this field, not just investigators, but everybody in the criminal justice system. When I worked in the UK's National Crime Agency in the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Centre, we had really good psychological care. We had to see a counsellor every couple of months to make sure that we dealt with intrusive images, that we dealt with things that could impact your own life, where maybe you were starting to burn out, or you didn't want to bathe your kids, or your sex life was being disrupted by it. So I think it's making sure that care is there for everybody. I'm lucky that I don't think that I've come away with any particular issues from dealing with this. I think most people who deal with this come away with a passion for doing something about it, and knowing that everything that we do for every child that we stop this happening to, it makes a difference, and we keep people safe. But certainly with every case like that, you leave a little bit of your humanity, a little bit of your soul behind in it.
Thanks so much, Neil.
Welcome. Thanks, Paulina.
I've been speaking with Neil Walsh from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. He leads the global program on cybercrime based in Vienna. Neil suggested some great websites on how to keep your child safer online. You can see those on our website at unmultimedia.org. I'm Paulina Greer. You've been listening to The Lid Is On, a podcast from UN News.